for people. So I'm just going to breathe for a few seconds. That'll give me a silent point in the tape. And ask if there might be any questions about this.
I don't know if I have any questions. It's extremely interesting, and it's an extremely difficult concept for me to grasp. And I guess my question is do you find that other people, is that normal to have a hard time grasping it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. Because I'm feeling a little bit dense here, but I'm just trying, to absorb it. And as most things, it'll come with time, but yeah. It's not sinking in 100% right now.
Every once in a while, Jan does something really dumb, like putting out a concept like the idealized self-image for a two-hour teleconference. that's my reality.
Uh-huh.
I sometimes don't realize it's a good idea to get started on it.
Uh-huh.
But you can do an entire weekend on the idealized self-image very, very easily. As a matter of fact, in the formal programs that Patrick presents, they normally do at least one weekend on this concept.
Yes, I could see that it could take a whole weekend.
So my idea was not... It never occurred to me I was going to clear this up for all of you. But because it is a little dense, it's possible that you might not have noticed what it was about if you'd passed through this lecture
mm-hmm.
and seen it. You might not have gotten some of the twists and turns.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal was to make it more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
My goal was to intrigue you
mm-hmm.
to read the lecture. The other thing is that although 83 stands a little bit alone, there's a series of lectures, 38 to 41, four lectures in a row about images.
Okay.
Then there is number 93, the main image. And then there are about five other lectures where image is in the title, including one lecture much later on called The Mass Images of Christianity and Judaism.
Well, so what was the last one you mentioned?
I'm not quoting it correctly, but it's in the 200s.
Okay.
Sorry, but I can only ballpark it for you. The Mass Images of Christianity and Judaism. And that lecture is fascinating because it talks about cultural images between two religions that one would think would be sisters
mm-hmm.
and how division is created in detail.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's not that those are the most important topics to address, but what the guide was doing was picking something that would hit the majority of his audience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So images are a primal concept in pathwork, and again, I had the gall to think that somebody might not know this, and you might like to hear about it.
It points up to me that phrase that one must know one's lag time between impact and absorption. And I think that if I can get that recording of what you did today and do some more reading on that, should give a help in trying to feature what I'm supposed to be absorbing.
Yeah. So let me tell you that I've been doing this for 12 years, nonstop, full time. And I didn't get this the first time around. It's not easy. And it's a personal choice as to how much time and effort you put into this. But my experience was that sometimes a slight piece of a concept really helped. In other words, a spoonful of this may be useful in your life. And that's enough. That'll do. I do want to address the question about self-talk. What would the ISI sound like? So, Wendy, you had the question. Has it been answered, or would you like me to go there?
Hi, I was muted. I'd just like some examples of phrases that you might hear inside yourself, just to really crystallize it.
Okay, no, that's fine. The reason I asked is you might have felt that your question got answered, and I do try not to bore people and repeat.
Okay, thanks.
And possibly people could help. In fact, this might be a good place to see who else is on board with this idea. So please feel free. I know that this isn't a room full of people, and it can feel a little awkward. But after all...
Well, I'm eager to be bored some more.
So what would it sound like? What do you think your idealized self-image tells you?
For me, my self-idealized self-image doesn't speak in words. It's just this pressure that I feel over really ridiculous, ridiculous things, and it's very compulsive, like you were saying earlier. And it just puts bizarre pressure on me to be very worried about things that are insignificant. And it takes up a lot of energy.
So that would be a drive for perfectionism.
Yes.
In every single thing at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be the idealized self-image, never leaving you alone.
Yeah.
And that's a good example of the tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody but me ever experienced somebody critiquing you, and you look at them going, what planet do you live on that you care about that? And yet they're technically correct?
Yeah.
I mean, God, I wish I had enough time in my day to worry about that level of nonsense. And yeah, okay, I guess you're correct, and that should have been addressed. But considering time constraints and considering what got done, it's petty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be an example of an outer version of an inner version of what the idealized self-image does to you,
mm-hmm.
where nothing is ever good enough, and you lay in bed at night, and all you can remember is what you did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Even if everybody in the room was thrilled, and you gave a surprise birthday party for somebody you loved, and everyone is wrapped, and the person is wrapped, and everything went perfectly, and you lay in bed at night going, too many red balloons, should have gotten more purple, what was I thinking? I mean, that's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
That's tyranny. That's insane. And that's
but
the
that can feed you. It seems like that can feed your resistance to doing anything else, and you might just become inactive altogether.
And that's where negativity will sit right next to the idealized self-image and feed it.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, a negative intentionality does not go up to you one day and say, see this axe? Why don't you kill your neighbor? That's just too gross. But if negativity can derail you through exhaustion, if negativity can make you try to do more than you're capable of doing so that you do part of it badly, and that allows people to critique you or feel dissatisfied, then for all your good intentions, negative results occur. And there's a place where good people just don't understand what happened. We had a good intention. We planned the party. We invited everybody. We put out the food. I don't understand why everybody's not content. And yet, if negativity entered into the situation, for instance, now I'm going to have to do this in a joke version. So the hostess meets every guest at the door and asks them to put little plastic booties on and gloves so that they will not leave fingerprints in the home. This would put a damper on the party spirit. Can you see where excess perfectionism, no matter how well-intentioned, can actually take away what you most desire.
Yes.
So that would be an example of how the idealized self-image would speak. It doesn't really speak in, you should do this. But it might shade how you do something to make it so much of a pain in the tush that you give up completely. It's just not worth the aggravation. So you come up with a scheme to do something, and your idealized self-image makes a chore out of it.
Yeah.
And then you just turn on the television and spend the evening doing that.
So, Jan, the idealized self-image is making you very far too detail-orientated. So what if you were to critique something yourself afterwards? Is that the idealized self-image, if you're going into all the details, like you're talking with your spouse about, yes, there were too many red balloons, if I did it next time I'd do it this way, and I wouldn't put gloves on them, just the booties would have been enough. You know, that sort of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you have to listen to the energy of the words, and this is where energy becomes critical, because the energy could be negative or lower self.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also be speaking from a collection of ideals that just aren't realistic. I'm going to risk, because in the United States we have a dense political climate at the moment, I'm going to risk sticking my toe in the water here, trying to stay very neutral in terms of issues, but noticing that none of our candidates are good enough.
Mm-hmm.
None. It's insane. We pick them to death. And yet, in theory, look at what it takes to become a candidate for high office in any country. Some countries, small islands in the Pacific with populations of 50, you might be able to just rise to the top for fun and not have to work hard. But for the rest of civilized countries, you have to earn a candidacy. You've got to put in time and effort. It is a lifetime task. And yet, once people get there, we tear them apart. When we tear them apart, we can be very justified. And we can feel very certain that we are following our highest instincts. But what is the net result of ripping someone to shreds? What does it do to the next person who's eyeing serving their nation or their country or even their town if they feel they have to go through that kind of gauntlet to give service? What happens is we self-select out people who only wanted to do service. And we manage to narrow the field to people who are driven with ambition. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm saying that people who aren't willing to slog through what has to be done to get elected in a democratic country are going to have a hard time if they don't have a driving force, if they don't have a push behind them.
Okay, I think you've lost me a little bit. Okay, let me see if I've got this. that we, as a collective group, you're saying, are setting the stage for anyone running for office to have to create that idealized self-image,
mm-hmm.
because we have set up so much criteria for them to be perfect.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
And I'm suggesting that it is our idealized self-image that is doing that.
Okay. And as a group. In other words, this is a problem. It's like a universal problem in our society, is what you're saying.
That's the example I'm using. I know that there are some countries and some areas of different countries where this is not so prevalent.
Uh-huh.
But I think it is prevalent in national elections.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm thinking that if that's true, then I guess I'm thinking that maybe it's not so much an individual problem just to me. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Most people don't have this problem, but I do.
Ah, okay.
Is what I was thinking. And now I think maybe I hear you saying most people have this problem.
I'm going to go even further than that. I'm going to say every person on the planet has that problem.
Okay.
That every society has that problem.
Uh-huh.
That every nation has that problem. And that the Earth population of humanity has that problem.
Hmm. Okay.
That we are a series. When we talk about these personality issues and these personal issues, and thank you for making this distinction, because I tend to do that and I do lose people sometimes,
mm-hmm.
because I do see it in large arenas as well as small.
Uh-huh.
That it is the very fact that each individual forms an idealized self-image, no matter how strong that is, that contributes to group idealized self-images. Where a nation winds up having a persona that it believes in, even when that persona is not true.
Mm-hmm.
So we emphasize our virtues and we conveniently de-emphasize or ignore negative aspects of our national characters.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I can see that.
So this is another way of looking at idealized self-image, and it also speaks to the kind of self-talk that was asked about. So what would idealized self-image talk about? We are all this. We believe in that. No, we don't. Some of us do, some of us don't. Okay? But because we believe we must create a united front, we minimize the fact that there are minority opinions within an individual human being. There are minority opinions based upon circumstance. I believe in life-affirming actions, and every once in a while, it doesn't work out. That's a minority opinion. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But from an idealized self-image, that doesn't present a united front. And so the idealized image wants something clear, distinct, and direct. Because subtlety is a province of the real self. That's who we are in our inner being. Complex, wonderful, fascinating, contradictory beings. And it is that very illogic of believing one thing and believing another and somehow being able to hold them both that it is difficult to communicate to others, and so we try to smudge it over. So I'm open to suggestion about where else you'd like to explore or discuss.
Well, I know that one of the issues that I always deal with is that being around a group of people always exhausts me. And I wish it wasn't that way, because many times it's just a set of circumstances where I would be enjoying myself. and yet it just simply exhausts me. And I'm wondering if that is because I'm dealing with my idealized self-image and feeling like I have to be a certain way in front of a group of people, and it just wears me out. Would that be possible that that's what it is?
Without telling you who you are, yes, that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how I would, when I think things through, when people ask me what I think almost mechanically sometimes. Exhaustion comes from putting out and not revitalizing from within.
Mm-hmm.
So we become exhausted when we are expending energy and we're not getting an influx of more energy. Now, some people, for instance, get energy from other people.
Right.
So being around people energizes them. For others, and I'm one of these, I also become exhausted when I'm around people because I'm a little scared. And I think that my shyness and my scaredness keeps me from connecting fully with people. So I believe that the people who get energy from other people, I think that they're actually more in reality than I am. That doesn't make me bad. But because I'm a little nervous, I don't fully connect with other people. That means that my reserves have to come from inside me. And some days I can supply that, and frankly, some days I can't.
Yeah.
So I can have both experiences. When I work on these teleconferences, I get stage fright like you guys can't believe 20 minutes beforehand. It's devastating. And I get energized in them because this work allows me to connect very deeply with people on a very real level. But if I was going to a social event, I tend to be not as connected with people. Unless I do the meditative woo-woo thing, you know, which makes you look like an idiot. It's not that I can't connect. It's that I don't connect well using social tools.
Mm-hmm.
But I can connect very well using the lecture materials. And speaking as best I can from my real self. And what scares me about the teleconferences is people will hear them cold. People I don't know. I know you guys either by voice or by email or whatever, and I'm comfortable. But the idea of strangers listening to my voice, it unnerves me. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't know how they would perceive my personality and character. And what frightens me is I certainly don't want them to turn off about the lectures because of the narrowness of my personality, if that makes sense. In other words, my personality appeals to a certain kind of person. If a person from another arena listens to this recording, they may or may not resonate with how I speak
mm-hmm.
or the examples I use.
Mm-hmm.
And my nightmare is they will say, "Puh, path work, not worth bothering about," and walk off. And I have to do a little self-talk. I think I'm also actually going back into how the ISI would self-talk. Okay? My ISI would say, be everything to everyone. You can do it, girl. But my personal feeling about that is that becomes a committee report. That becomes white bread. That takes all the dumb mistakes out, and it doesn't permit me to say things like my mother tried to get me into a girl when I was 12. I mean, these things aren't appropriate to say in front of strangers, and yet that very silliness is who I am.
Mm-hmm.
If I take the silliness out, I'm honestly not sure that the words themselves have that much value. Because you can read the lectures. Can you see where the idealized self-image might want me to clean up my act to the point where I actually became uninteresting? Instead of accepting that some people find my sense of humor and my examples too hard to deal with.
Okay, so how do we handle the idealized self-image by recognizing it and confronting it? And does it go away, or does it always resurface? Or once we understand it, are we no longer vulnerable to fall back into it?
So if you take the questionable tone out of your voice, I think you just said everything perfectly.
Well, it was a question. It had a question mark after
it. If you had that little, am I doing the right thing? Am I saying the right thing? If you took that tone out of what you just said, you'd be teaching idealized self-image.
Oh.
Because what you said is exactly how to deal with it. First, you have to notice it. Consciousness. The guide's work is about becoming conscious of our process, becoming conscious of how we think, becoming conscious of the dynamics in our feelings, instead of simply allowing the feeling itself to exist. We have to wrap it in stuff. In answer to your question, will it ever go away? I invite you to answer that question. Do you think it will ever go away?
No.
That's the answer. I should.
No.
If you wanted a different one, I can't give it to you.
For myself personally, I think it's just something I'm vulnerable to because of the way I was raised and my past experiences. And I think I have a vulnerability to fall into it. So I guess I just need to work on constant awareness.
If you were in the room with everybody who is on this teleconference call, I would bet money that you would see nodding heads as you speak. And if anybody would like to validate what she said, she might like to hear it. Anybody else got those feelings?
I couldn't hear her very clearly. I did notice that she also had a question in her voice at the end of that last statement.
That's okay.
But,
here's a statement on the table, okay? How many of us believe that we might have an idealized self-image?
Yes.
Go ahead. I know that's hard because everybody doesn't want to speak up at once, but let me ask it this way. Does anyone here truly, honestly believe that they have never experienced the idealized self-image? Okay, it's kind of reverse psychology, but can you accept that as everybody's got it?
I can.
Okay.
I didn't realize people couldn't hear me, and evidently that's part of the problem.
Well, I'm not perfectly aware what people can hear. I heard you clearly, and there are differences in our telephones.
Yeah. Okay.
But I think you might have been heard by several of the people involved here. And this is where telephone conferences are slightly awkward. It's difficult for everybody to chime in or nod.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to take the bull by the horns and tell you that I have never experienced anybody in my lifetime who does not deal with the idealized self-image. That I have never dealt with anybody, ever, including myself, who doesn't share the feelings that you expressed.
Okay, well, I'm not alone. That's good to know.
Yeah. And that's one of the things about working with anyone else, but especially groups of people. And I want to be very clear that it doesn't have to be in this context, or it doesn't have to be in a specific context. But that's why we seek out people of like mind. So my point of view would be this. My point of view would be that your real self wants the freedom to be imperfect, because that's what it is. The phrase, you are a child of God, implies that you are in development. The phrase is not, you are a four-star major general in God's army and have nothing else left to learn. The phrase is that you are a child of God. And with spiritual communities, discussions of being a child of God or having an inner child resonate, and I believe that there's a universal resonance there, because there is every human being, there's some part of us that is undergoing development. So your individualized, idealized self-image may not be a massive factor in areas where you are well-developed, because there you can relax. You have already got the confidence you need. You don't have to push. You're good enough. That the idealized self-image is a problem in areas where we are developing. That's the place where we feel we need to hide, because we are actually working there, and therefore we know that we're not perfect. We know that we fall short. Now, the positive to all this, how would you know that you were falling short if there wasn't some part of you, and I don't care how big that part is, there must be some part of you that knows what enough feels like to tell you you're not enough. And I'm not talking about the outer world, I'm talking about the inner world. Can you see where I'm going on this? In a kind of a backwards way, if it was only the outer world telling you weren't enough, you would give them what they needed, you would put on the mask, you would wear the clothing, go out, perform, and come back, and be completely confident and self-satisfied in your inner life. But that is not the reality of the people I work with. The people I work with feel that there is something lacking. And I am speaking right now to the positive aspect of that. How do you know? And my answer to that is, you know, because you know what the unitive feels like. You know because you know God. You know because you know divinity. You know goodness because you can access goodness. You just can't manifest it 24 hours a day. You know kindness. And kindness, by the way, derives from the word kin. To be connected, to be a relative of. So in the kinship of all of us being one, we understand inherently that we should be kind to each other. And therefore we feel when we are unkind. We notice it. If you did not know what kind was, how could you possibly know what unkind was? So where the idealized self-image is concerned, the positive of this is some part of you has an image. has a little ghostly picture. And that ghostly picture may actually represent where you're headed as a spirit. And that's where the power comes from. That's why this damn thing is so attractive. That's how it gets you. It isn't a foreign thing. It is you. 50 years in the future, 500 years in the future, 5 weeks into the future, but not today. Can you feel the positive quality of being able to imagine who you are in such a glorious, enlightened state? And can you sense the disappointment when moment by moment, day by day, you see that you're not there yet?
Well, that's it.
But Jan, that image we have of the enlightened state, I mean, that's also created by the idealized self-image to some extent, isn't it? I mean,
to some extent. I'm talking about the positive, however.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm saying that the idealized self-image has power because it has a point of view that has correctness to it.
Yeah.
I'm saying the idealized self-image, it is a really beautiful phrase. Listen to the phrase. The idealized self-image. It's a beautiful concept if it wasn't such a jerk. I'm talking about how the idealized self-image gets your attention. I'm talking about how it gets its power. And it gets its power because it does hold your dreams. And what I'm speaking to is, if it has your dreams, then you have your dreams. And that your real self just needs to allow and encourage and support your own development, and you'll get there without a whip. What I'm suggesting is that the idealized self-image is reality used against you instead of for you. But there's nothing wrong with hanging that picture on the wall and looking at it every single day saying, that's what I want to be. What can I do about that today? That's the positive. And when we talk about problems, we need to remember that we're talking about problems, not the entire picture. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, I really feel the urge to tell a silly story, and I'm going to do it. When I was in my first year of Pathwork program, I also had gone on a blind date with a pilot. What was I thinking? I didn't know pilots could be bad pilots, but that's something I learned later. He was good, but for all I knew, I was going up with a kamikaze. Later I learned to gauge pilots more accurately. Anyway, I went on a blind date with a pilot, and he asked me, would you like to fly? And I put my hands on the wheel, and it was as if the viral qualities of piloting came through the wheel into my hands, and I was permanently infected. So I began taking flight lessons. So my first year of Pathwork studies, my classmates were at first entertained and then irritated by constant stories of how Pathwork works with flight lessons. And that's where this story comes from. When I was up with my instructor, we would land and we would go to the conference room, and he would give me the list of what I had done. I'm going to use the word wrong. It was just, here's the list of things you need to improve, or where you made the wrong radio message, or you didn't do it, whatever it was. Okay, let's use wrong as shorthand for things that needed to be addressed. And he would give me a list. Now, instructors are trained not to discourage people, so they don't give you the full list. They just give you what you can handle that day. And then as you get better, they go down to the more and more subtle layers that they weren't able to tell you before. And then comes the magic day when you solo, and then comes the days when you are allowed to fly on your own with permission slips. You're allowed to do X, Y, and Z on your own. And what I found once I started doing that was that I had to come up with my own list because there wasn't anybody else up there but me. And because I had to drive 45 minutes home from the airport, I would spend the 45 minutes going home going over my list. I never wrote it down, but I had that 45 minutes to debrief on the mistakes I had made. I likened this to daily review in a very short, encapsulized format. And that is how I approach daily review. One day, I was driving home, and I thought, what's wrong with this picture? There's something wrong. I've forgotten something, and I realized that that day, in my brief 45-minute solo work that I had done, I had not made a single mistake that was worth discussing. That was a revelatory day. I didn't have too many of those. But that day, I couldn't recall a single genuine thing that I needed to caution myself against and bone up in the book to do. And it was a great feeling. And the next time I flew, I didn't feel badly because I had one or two or three things. But I remember the day. It felt great. I had become competent to a certain level, and naturally, I went further. And when I went further, and I tested myself more, of course, I found things to critique. And what I am presenting is that, relatively speaking, I'm not saying that I'm perfect, and I'm not saying I'm mature in all areas, but in my flying, I tended to be mature. I tended not to beat myself up. I didn't ban myself from the skies, although my instructor tried once. I tried to take a very realistic and appropriate attitude towards it. And this is a useful attitude to have towards yourself. So I found that I was learning in this arena a way of doing data review, a way of identifying the objective observer. I did relate the idealized self-image to this, a place where I hated to make mistakes in front of other people. It wasn't the mistake I hated, it was in front of other people, because otherwise I could ignore it. And what I realized was I need to make mistakes in front of other people because otherwise I might ignore it. So, for the same reason I use films when I teach, it's useful to use a different arena of your life, because the area that you're doing your developmental work in can feel very sensitive, and it can sometimes even feel bruised. Because you're working there, because you're not fully developed there, you may feel very sensitive sometimes to critique, even from yourself. But if you look at another aspect of your life, where you act as a professional, where you're a grandmother, where you are a parent, where you work with people in a community service environment, where you talk to your neighbor, these areas might be really clean areas, areas that don't have a lot of high drama, where you don't make a fool of yourself, and you don't act out, and there's no negativity. Find one of those areas and use it as a template and say, when I make a mistake there, what do I do? what you'll probably find is that you may discuss it with others, or you may go, I think I'll do it differently next time. But there isn't this overwhelming sense of shame. There isn't a crippling fear. There isn't a feeling of being an avalanche of judgment. In these healthy areas, you'll find a template for how to support yourself in the tender, growing areas where you're developing. So are there possibly other questions, or every once in a while I would think that we'd be done with this teleconference perhaps ahead of time, so I don't object to being done, and I'm checking.
That was very helpful material today.
Assume for a moment that we just might be done. And maybe because the material is so dense, this subject does require more study on your part and is less able for me to deliver it. And that may be the contradictory reason why we'd be done early. On the next teleconference, I am going to dive into a murky territory. I am going to dive between the lines of the lectures and talk about soul movements. And the reason that is murky is because although soul movements are mentioned by the guide, there's no lecture on it. There's a lecture on eros, and there are lectures on dreams, but there is no weaving of what I find the guide talks about, five different soul movements, putting them all together. And one of the ways I was taught pathwork was not to rote by rote go down the lectures, but to stand back and take a larger perspective and perhaps find themes and ideas that aren't delineated paragraph by paragraph by paragraph, but are there. And that's what the 50-50 work in pathwork speaks to. So the five soul movements are thoughts. Not thinking, thoughts, the difference. Feelings, as differentiated from emotion. Eros, which has its own wonderful lecture. Dreams, which has two or three lectures actually devoted to it. And imagination, which although the guide does not specifically address in a lecture, he speaks of it with great respect. And I found that interesting. The respect with which the guide invites people to imagine. And perhaps this is because of my prejudice, a prejudice that was attempted to be put on me from childhood. And I believe that some of you may relate to the phrase, it's just your imagination. Being put forward as a put-down of what you have put forward. Mm-hmm. Well, the guide doesn't say that. The guide refers to imagination as a tool, as a way of thinking and perceiving that is special. And because I do believe in the guide lectures, and I believe that the guide doesn't say things accidentally like people do sometimes, although the power of the word would say that nobody says anything by accident, I am entranced when the guide respects imagination and dreams and also thoughts, because thinking is sometimes disparaged in spiritual work. But thought is respected by the guide. again, as a tool for raising consciousness. And in effect, what I find is with these soul movements that there are many, many ways to find the truth and to raise consciousness. So that's what I was going to do next time, was play just a little bit.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah. So the material's online. You can download it. Mostly quotes rather than worksheets. And that's partly because I just don't work ahead of time. So I did a lot of work in the last 2 days, and it wasn't online. And I will send those notes out to you after we finish the custom. So thank you very much for being here. I think we're done.
Thank you, Jen.
It was very interesting.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, everybody.
It was a pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hope to hear with you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.